thanks for having me, Harry. I am going to talk about the blessing that is the national debt. I also want to say, Vance's talk reminded me to make one plug for one more book. I'm publishing kind of the collected works of Arthur Laffer of The Economist. We've been releasing some volumes. The volume that's going to come out this summer is a volume of Laffer and his company's papers on energy policy since 1979. People always say the supply siders are cranks. Well, we actually have the historical evidence of what they said at every juncture. Arthur Laffer called the peak of the oil price in 1980. He called the bottom in 1986. He said in 2006 that oil will collapse in 2008, and then he said after that a rumble up would continue. It's a funny thing, if you actually look at the historical sources of supply-side revolution, they call all the market junctures. University of Virginia produced an economist, John Rutledge, who was Reagan's first econometrician. He was the one who called the bull market in the 1980s. How's that for a prediction? Okay, so I'm going to talk about this blessing, this national debt. You know, Amity Schlaes made this great observation this morning about Calvin Coolidge worried about cutting tax rates because it might increase revenue, and then government would get large. That, of course, is the essence of the Laffer curve. The Republicans actually were the first to make that argument. As the historian Douglas Irwin observed, when the Republican Congress stifled Grover Cleveland's attempt to cut the tariff in 1888, and their argument was, well, the government will become big if we cut the tariff because revenue will be up. But let me tell you, as we've seen in the income tax era, when you cut income tax rates and revenue goes up, there is no demand for the revenue and spending actually goes down. So the last time nominal spending decreased in the United States before 2010 was 1964 to 1965. Nominal spending went down, and that was after the very significant John F. Kennedy tax cut came in. What happened is there was such a big economic boom that nobody wanted the government dull, and so the government actually couldn't spend the money because the private sector was becoming so impressive. So I don't think we should fear tax rate cuts on those grounds at all. One more quick anecdote. You know, in the 1980s, there was all this hand-wringing about how our grandchildren are going to have to pay for Ronald Reagan's incredible debt. I mean, we have these huge $200-plus billion debts after these tax cuts in the 1980s. And how many times in the 1980s did we hear that our grandchildren are going to have to pay that off? Well, we know what happened to Reagan's debts. They were completely eliminated by economic growth. And that's what Ronald Reagan said in the 1980s. We'll grow our way out of it. Oh, yeah? What's the evidence of that? Here's Alan Greenspan speaking in 2001. This is the chairman of the Federal Reserve speaking in 2001 to a bondholders' convention in White Sulphur Springs, Virginia. You know what his theme was? We are in danger of paying off the entire debt of the United States, and the Federal Reserve will not be able to conduct open market operations anymore because there will be no more treasuries. And he said this is actually the future that the Federal Reserve has to contemplate now because of this incredible 18-year run of economic growth. Here's how Greenspan concluded in 2001. Finally, in the period ahead, the Federal Reserve will be seeking active consultations and discussions with you, the bond market, and other market participants, as well as with the Congress, before significant changes are made to Federal Reserve procedures and methods, because there's not going to be any Treasury debt. While the prospective paydown of Treasury debt, Greenspan said, presents us with challenges, I am confident that, with your help, the Federal Reserve can make the needed adjustments and will be able to continue to implement monetary policy in the national interest. The benefits of reducing our federal debt make the associated challenges well worth meeting. The idea that growth could pay off the debt scared the living daylights out of the Federal Reserve because it would put an end to the Federal Reserve. And it's funny, I actually think that speech is the inflection point where we stopped paying off the debt, and then since then the debt has skyrocketed. There was actually kind of a qui bono relationship between the perception the Fed had about its own existential requirements. You need the debt to exist. So that was a missed opportunity, wasn't it, in the 2000s? If we had continued to grow economically, we would not have a Federal Reserve today, let alone a national debt. All right, what is the problem with the economy today? What has our problem been now, 8 years since the Great Recession? Is it that the United States is greatly in debt with something like $10 trillion in Treasury bonds outstanding? Well, actually, clearly this is not the problem, at least in any kind of primary sense. We heard about Adam Smith's concerns on this score this morning. If there were not today upwards of 20 million Americans who are underemployed, if privately held student loan, housing, and automotive debt were not preventing legion Americans from spreading their wings, economically speaking, today, if the predicament of living in Section 8 housing, being on Obamacare, and collecting the earned income tax credit did not, as they do, make effective marginal tax rates on the poor about 80% on average today, then we would have the luxury of saying that the manifest insolvency of the federal government is a primary problem. The economy, after all, exists for one reason, to serve humanity, in its material needs and in our penchant to work. If humanity is not flourishing in the economy, particularly an economy like ours that has routinely been great, that is the problem, the full scope of it. The government's financial predicament cannot matter in any kind of ultimate sense, since the only thing that does matter economically is people broadly doing very well. It is possible along these lines to conceive a scenario in which the economy does well and the government does not, financially speaking. It is not possible. It is clear enough that what the government has to do to ensure that the economy prospers, such that there is significant sustained economic growth and jobs and opportunity for everyone in the nation. It's very clear what the government has to do. It has nothing to do with the debt. There have to be low tax rates, statutory and effective. There has to be a currency, the dollar presumably, that is consistently valuable against classic market hedges against poorly managed currencies. Gold is the most classic of these hedges. There has to be spare regulation, domestically and internationally, domestically in terms of little governmental interference in the natural ways of business, and internationally in terms of few, if any, trade barriers. Arthur Laffer has called these four things, low tax rates, sound money, spare regulation, and free trade, the pillars of Reaganomics. The fifth one is low spending. The thing to note here is that, again, like in 64, 65, when the economy booms on account of the first four pillars, there is no market for government spending, and it begins to dry up as a matter of course. If we discarded interest in peripheral issues, the national debt, the federal fisc, or what have you, and simply adjusted policy so that it be growth and free market maximizing, we would have a phenomenal economy. The economic history of the United States is clear on this point. We would be, in this 21st century, a nation of 320 million well-off people, most of us rather fulfilled at work, loving the opportunities available for us, planning for the future, and enjoying considerable leisure. Low tax rates, sound dollar, spare domestic and trade regulation, there you have it, the private economy's problems completely solved. Let us imagine that in such a circumstance, the federal budget is grossly imbalanced. How could it possibly matter? Who would be harmed? Would bondholders, for example, be hurt by potential default? How could they be, since the financial portfolio of a booming nation includes untold valuable classes of assets for every single one that fails to perform? This is not to mention the risk premium priced into all bonds. When everyone's rich, who cares if the United States government defaults? You have a ton of other assets. Would promises for the future, Social Security, Medicare, and so forth, not be kept because of the huge debt? Again, how exactly could this pain be felt in real terms, in that the premise is that the nation is supremely well off? If, say, because of the national debt, a particular leg on the stool of retirement or healthcare become weak, every other leg, by definition, would have to be manfully strong for the premise to be maintained. How does a nation in which the broad majority has done very well throughout life not have sufficient resources? By definition, given sustained economic growth, there are sufficient resources, no matter the accountancy of the federal government. The accountancy of the federal government is irrelevant in any sense that matters to the real lives of human beings once economic growth sets in for good. The great size of the debt of the federal government of the United States has done a very great disservice to our thinking about economic priorities. There is simply no reason whatsoever for tax rates not to be low, for the dollar not to be continually good against gold and currency substitutes, for the government's snout not to be kept out of business, domestic and foreign. No reason at all in that when these policies are adhered to, the economy roars permanently, and the affluent results are experienced by hundreds of millions. A monstrous debt is not a legitimate reason for prescinding from free market principles. For the success of an uninhibited free market necessarily eliminates all financial problems. Economic growth of a major degree, again, as it usually has been the lot of the United States to experience, renders all debts trifling. mass prosperity cannot abide debt, in that even numerically large debt cannot have any meaning in a real sense if everyone is well off. We should indeed ignore the debt to such a degree that our only focus, our relentless focus when it comes to economic policy, is the set of the four pillars of Reaganomics: low tax rates, a good dollar, spare regulation, and free trade. With government spending losing its applicability as the whole nation bolts for the newly glowing opportunities in the private sector. I'd like to add a few words about monetary policy. It is actually untenable for the United States to run both a monetary and a tax system, the institutions of 1913 simultaneously. If the United States ran its monetary system well, there would be no need for a tax system. Furthermore, to the degree that the United States does have a tax system, it is equal and opposite the degree to which the United States cannot have a good monetary system. Let me clarify. The world's dominant currency issuer necessarily is able to create money and have people readily exchange their own goods and services for this currency, given that it is dominant. In economics, this is called seigneurial privilege, the benefit that accrues to an actor in the economy who can actually get rich by making money in the literal sense, which is what the Federal Reserve does. Given that the United States can introduce over $1 trillion, probably about $2 trillion per year, into the world economy free and clear, the degree of our seigneurial privilege, the government of the United States, if it kept its spending to this level, $1 or $2 trillion annually, would not have any revenue need for a tax system. Indeed, having a tax system would cost the government money, in that the tax system necessarily makes one's currency less valuable to the economy at large. A tax system increases the nominal rate of return that must be gained in any enterprise in order for there to be a real rate of return. It lowers the profit margin. That's what taxes do. A tax system lessens the free demand for currency that a currency issuer bids to satisfy. Lower or eliminate taxes and the demand for currency, and thus the currency issuer's ability to procure real goods and services with that currency in the given transactions area, goes way up. In our overly great concern over the national debt these years, we have forgotten how ridiculous it is not only to get tax rates down, but to have them or regulation at all. We would actually eliminate the revenue needs of the government if we eliminated the revenue system. There's no reason whatsoever for the issuer of the world's dominant currency, the dollar of all things, to have any need for extra financing sources than their own issue of the currency. This cuts to the heart of the predicament that Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen now finds herself in. And Larry Kudlow, my co-author, just wrote about this yesterday in Real Clear Markets, if you want to see his very similar views to what I'm saying right now. Janet Yellen is trying to make the dollar a little more valuable against the classic hedges, gold and such, and thus prompt investment and jobs, but is having problems getting anywhere with her modest, un-Bernanke-like moves. The reason has little to do with the Fed per se. Rather, the reason is that the dollar is less valuable now as an investment medium on account of the march-up of tax rates on rich and poor. The nastiest ones have been on the doubling of effective tax rates on the poor, along with the eye-popping march-up of regulation over these Obama years. A dollar deployed in enterprise cannot make as much profit these days for all the laid-on taxes and regulation. Therefore, there is less real demand for the dollar. All the Fed policy in the world cannot change this fact unless the fiscal state retreats. If we cut tax rates, regulation, and trade barriers today, the demand for the dollar would swell, and Chair Yellen's job would become a piece of cake. We often forget that Paul Volcker tried everything possible for his first 3 years as chair of the Fed, 1979 to 82, to get the dollar good again. His moves only found traction in 1982 when the Reagan tax cut began to phase in. Kemp Roth made Paul Volcker. Let me stress that the secret to renewing this economy is in the palm of our hand. If we recommitted to the pillars of Reaganomics, the upcoming years would turn into dust. The problems we somehow are now beginning to convince ourselves are insoluble. Thank you.